Srimad Bhagavatam, 8th Canto, Chapter 1, Anonymous Administrators of the Universe, text number 4. Sri Sivacha, Manasmingatatitasa, Kalbe Swayam Bhuvalaya, Ajaste Katitu Yatra, Devadinam Chasambhava. Sukadev Goswami said, in the present Kalpa, there have already been 6 Manus. I have described to you Swayambhuva Manu and the appearance of many demigods. In this Kalpa Brahma, Swayambhuva is the first Manu. Akuchan deva huchancha duitrustasya vaima dharma jnana padeshatam bhagavan putratam gatata. Translation. Swayambhuva Manu had 2 daughters named Akuchi and Devahuti. From their wombs, the Supreme Personality of Godhead appeared as 2 sons named Yajnamurti and Kapila respectively. These sons were entrusted with preaching about religion and knowledge. Purport. Devahuti's son was known as Kapila and Akuti's son known as Yajnamurti. Both of them taught about religion and philosophical knowledge. It's interesting that both sisters had the Supreme Personality of Godhead as their son. Another point, we saw in the previous verse that it was described that already 6 Manus had appeared in this Kalpa. And that is interesting because Krishna appears in the 7th Manvantara, right, in the 28th millennium. We discussed that there are 71 millennia in a Manvantara, in a period of Manu. So during the reign of the 7th Manu, in the 28th of the 71 millennia, Krishna appears like that. And then, of course, Lord Chaitanya also. So we are now in that one, in the 28th millennium of the 7th Manvantara. So here we can see how Bhagavatam is actually exactly giving also the date of when all this transpired. One can easily calculate it back. And in that way, sometimes it is said that Bhagavatam is not chronological. But here we see like a very clear chronological element in Srimad Bhagavatam. Which is important because Bhagavatam is not just mythological. It is actually factual and historical, and that is important. These are all historical personalities. All the personalities in Bhagavatam are historical, even although sometimes some of them appear to be mythological. For example, take Priyavrata, who is somewhat dissatisfied with the functioning of the sun. He doesn't like it that it turns, that the sun sets and then it becomes night. So he himself decides to create like another sun, a chariot. He also rides around the sky in a chariot, but his chariot functions better than the sun because no more night and a perfect temperature and so on. Everything going very well. But in the course of riding around, Priyavrata's chariot wheels are cutting the landmass into 7 pieces, and then you get the 7 continents. This is not mythology. This is historical and factual. Srimad Bhagavatam, believe it or not. So there are aspects in Bhagavatam which sometimes appear very mythological. They have a mythological appearance. But here we have direct chronological, historical evidence from Srimad Bhagavatam. And of course, that puts a highly civilized life on Earth way before the prehistoric era. We could easily calculate it back in some way. There's nothing better to do. Can come back this evening and tell us exactly when in the prehistoric times all this took place. I didn't do my homework, so sorry about that. Anyway, Krishna appears again and again in various forms. Paritranai sadhanam vinasya sadushkritam dharmasam stapanatiya sambhavami yuke. To establish the principles of religion and to annihilate the demons, the Supreme Personality God appears again and again in this world, in his expansions. But there is a distinct difference between the Supreme Lord himself and his expansions, because in his own personal form, the Lord has a dual purpose. He comes to display his eternal pastimes of the spiritual world to his devotees, to attract his devotees, and to bring his devotees back to the level of the spiritual world. And then he also establishes the principles of religion and annihilates the demons, which is generally the work of the incarnations of the Lord, or the avatars of the Lord, or the Vishnu forms of the Lord. But Krishna himself is doing more. He is revealing transcendence. So it is interesting, because therefore we see that Krishna is sometimes acting contradictory. When Krishna is acting as the one who is establishing the principles of Dharma, then Krishna acts exactly as an incarnation. Then Krishna is outside of Vrindavan. Outside of Vrindavan, he is known as Yadav Kumar, the son of the Yadavas, or of the Yadu dynasty in particular. In Vrindavan, he is known as Nandanandan or Yasodanandan, as the son of Nanda and Yasoda. He is not referred to as Yadu Kumar or Yadav Kumar. Yadav Kumar is obviously the son of the Yadu dynasty, the son of Vasudev and Devaki. How can the residents of Vrindavan consider Vasudev and Devaki Krishna's parents, Nanda and Yasoda, other parents? So, in this way, Krishna is there residing in Vrindavan. And in Vrindavan, Krishna is transcendental to mundane morality. And Krishna himself establishes transcendental morality, which is whatever Krishna does is wonderful, no matter what it is. If he steals, wonderful. Whatever he does, it is ecstatic. So, whereas in Dwarka, Krishna is strictly adhering by the principles of Dharma. It is said that Narada Muni came to see Krishna in Dwarka, and he visited Krishna in all his different palaces. And that time Krishna was had multiplied himself in 16,108 forms, and there Narada was visiting all these various forms of Krishna who resided each in their own palace. And it was interesting, because in one palace Krishna was speaking with his ministers and making a strategy of how to deal with various opponents and so on. In another palace, Krishna was resting. In another palace, Krishna was engaged in puja. In another palace, Krishna was playing with his children. Like this, Krishna was acting different in each of the palaces, but he was engaging in ordinary household affairs. And then the Krishna book continues, and in the next chapter, it is called Krishna's Daily Activities, and then it describes how Krishna in his daily activities is rising early in the morning, and how he is reciting prayers, how he's seeing auspicious things like a marble statue of a cow. So we also have some cows on the altar. And you, it's very auspicious. You may wonder, why cows on the altar? Because Krishna, Krishna is cooking in the morning, and cows. And it is ultimately established as Dharmam to Saksat Bhagavat Pranitam, that all religious principles begin with Krishna. It doesn't begin anywhere else. It's not that we are manufacturing our own. Krishna is establishing simply what religious principles are. So Krishna in the early morning engages in meditation, and he meditates on himself. Of course, that could be misunderstood, and Srila Prabhupada dedicates 1.5 pages to make sure that it's not understood in the wrong way. He points out the impersonalists, they are also meditating on themselves. So hum, I am that too. Yes, tat tvam asi. Yes, I am also Brahman. That's not the purpose. No, Krishna is not meditating on Brahman. Krishna is meditating on himself, on Krishna. He's meditating on Krishna, on the all-attractive Supreme Lord, on Bhagavan, who is full of unlimited varieties of qualities and pastimes, and that is the aim, to meditate on him, on Bhagavan. So in this way, Dharma Sanstarpanantiya, Krishna is establishing the religious principles for all to follow in his form of Yadav Kumar. In that way, he acts. But there is another part of Krishna, and Krishna himself is, while he is in this form of Yadav Kumar, is attracted to the Krishna, the cowherd boy in Vrindavan. And there is a reference where Yadav Kumar, this is Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Yadav Kumar is speaking and saying, how amazing is it that when I think of that particular form of Krishna in Vrindavan, that I desire to become a maidservant. Like that, he is saying. Yes. So, in this way, the form of Krishna in Vrindavan is the form that can attract all. He even attracts the Krishna in Dwarka. He can attract the minds of all, because in that form, Krishna is performing the most amazing pastimes. Still, when we hear descriptions of Dwarka, it's quite something, quite something amazing, Dwarka also. Palaces, the doorways made of beautiful carved wood or marble, palaces with marble walls, the doorways inlaid with various stones and diamonds, and the doors made of silver, and of course with decorated pounded panels depicting pastimes, and set the streets which are washed with rose water which has been sprayed throughout the street to the trunks of elephants. Krishna in the early morning is giving away thousands of cows, all decorated with golden horns and golden hoofs. So Krishna's opulence in Dwarka is something extraordinary. There are beautiful parks filled with very amazing birds and so on, and it is like a city which is so beautiful. And then early in the morning, after Krishna has completed his puja and his worship, then comes the entertainment, and then many artists are coming, and they are coming to perform their arts for Krishna. They sing, they dance, and of course all various dances and songs that glorify the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in this way, it is also culturally very, very rich. These artists are extremely expert musicians, extremely expert dancers, and or orators, various brahmanas that recite verses that are very, very appropriate, and everyone is feeling satisfied in just hearing such verses that are so suitable, so perfectly suitable for the occasion. Like in this way, Dwarka is very subtle and satisfying the senses, satisfying the mind. It is all inspiring and pleasing in Dwarka. Mm. In Vrindavan, Krishna is more simple. He is a cowherd boy. But it's not that in Vrindavan, Krishna is not living in some level of opulence, because Srila Baladev Vijayabhusan has written a book called Aishwarya Kadambini. And in this Aishwarya Kadambini, he is describing the opulence of Krishna. It's interesting. Generally, it is said Aishwarya, opulence, isn't that sort of like Kunta or Dwarka? But here, Baladev Vijayabhusan is describing the Aishwarya that exists in Vrindavan. And he's describing that Krishna lives in this beautiful palace with columns of lapis lazuli and also inlaid with jewels and amazing onyx seats with comfortable cushions covered with silk covers, embroidered, of course, so very beautiful at the same time. There is a system on Nandishwara Hill where Krishna resides, of waterways, and there are pipes of bamboo that bring the water to the houses. So certainly you can see how the ladies there in Nandishwar are going outside of the house carrying pots on their head, like you will see all over India, but not to bring water, because they have running water. Yes, they have running water. But the pots therefore must contain milk. What else is possible? That is the case. And then it says that running water is abundantly available, because on the garden wall of Nanda Maharaj's palace there is a waterfall all around. So it is extremely opulent, extremely opulent. And then in the morning, Radharani is every day brought to the house of Yasoda to cook for Krishna. And she's carried in a palanquin. And around her there are many gopis and maidservants with chamaras and so on. So every morning it's a very opulent procession when Radharani is going to the palace of Yasoda. So in this way, some of the opulence of Vrindavan may also be noted. But the difference is that in Vrindavan, the opulence is not, it is there, but it is in the background. It's not as much in the foreground as in Dwarka. In Dwarka, Krishna is seated in the morning in the Sudarma assembly house on a throne. And it is said to the right of him is his father, Vasudev, and also Ugrasena. And Ugrasena is seated a little bit forward, because after all he's still respected as the king. And then to the left there are other prominent personalities, like Satyaki. And then Uddhava is there, and Uddhava is intimately speaking with Krishna. And Uddhava is so learned, being the disciple of Brihaspati, that practically Uddhava is able to speak in ways that no one can understand. He hints from so many things, and since he has so much knowledge, people are missing the point. But only Krishna, who is after all the source of all knowledge. We see that when Krishna is being educated by Sandipani Muni, then it is described that Krishna is like the ocean, and that the cloud of knowledge from that ocean is finding a repository in the form of the mountain of Sandipani Muni, and that then the knowledge that originally came from that ocean finds its place at that mountain of Sandipani Muni, and then in the form of streams, that knowledge is coming from Sandipani Muni and just streaming in all directions. That is how learned he is. And in this way, Sandipani Muni is teaching Krishna, who then receives this same knowledge again. But he is the source of that knowledge. In the same way, a spiritual master is also described, Sansara Dhavanada Lila Loka Antranaya Karuna Ganaganatvam. Ganaganatvam is referring to the rain cloud. And that the spiritual master is like a rain cloud of mercy. And Srila Prabhupada explained, but he has no mercy of his own. That mercy is simply Krishna's mercy. And the spiritual master, whatever mercy he has, it is Krishna's mercy that he is passing on. Of course, what he can add to it is his own prayer that he can add. That's all. He cannot give anything that didn't come from Krishna, but he can add his own prayer to Krishna. Oh Krishna, please, please deliver this conditioned soul. So this is there. But for example, it says, Guru Krishna Rupa Haya Shastra Praman Guru Rupa Krishna Kripa Karena Bhakta Gan. It is stated in Adi Lila 145. It is said that actually it is not the Guru who is delivering the disciple. It is Krishna through Guru who is delivering the disciple. And that is an important point. The Guru is the mailman. He is delivering the goods, and it must be unchanged and unaltered. And obviously, Tamal Krishna Maharaj gave that example that he is like, he's like the mailman, and it's not that he can open the letter and then he reads the letter and then it says in the letter that pay an amount of, you know, like 50,000 to Shamananda, and the mailman changes it and says, no, not to Shamananda, to me. And he changes it to me. Pay 50,000 to me. That's not possible. That's cheating. But the Mayavadi gurus are like such mailmen who change the message. Soham, I am. But it is not soham. Das soham. Das soham. Do the acharyas say not soham? Das soham. I am servant. Not I am that too. No, I am servant. So therefore the spiritual master must be a servant. Otherwise, how is he spiritual master? Only by being servant. And Gopi Bhaktapada Kamaliya Dasana Dasana Das, a servant 100 times removed. Not the direct servant of Krishna, but the servant of the servant of Krishna. So in this way, we are looking at Krishna and his devotees. So everything finds its origin in Krishna. Krishna is the first one who performs devotional service. Krishna himself is worshipping, and Krishna expands himself as Balaram. And Balaram is Adi Guru, the original spiritual master who shows how to serve. Because Balaram serves Krishna in any possible way. Balaram, first of all, becomes a menial servant. He becomes the bed, he becomes the plate, he becomes the shoes, he becomes the seat, he becomes the musical instruments that are used for the glorification of the Lord. So in this way, Balaram provides all the needs that the Lord has. Balaram not only becomes that, Balaram also becomes the pleasure grounds where the Lord is performing his pastimes. Therefore, it is Balaram who becomes Vrindavan. That is also there. So in this way, Balaram is serving Krishna as a menial servant in so many ways. Balaram then expends himself, and he becomes the Purusha avatars. He becomes, from him emanates Mahavishnu, Garbhadaksari Vishnu, Iksirudaksari Vishnu. So it is Balaram again who is dealing with the material energy. Right? It is Balaram. And Balaram becomes Lord Sankarshan. He expands himself as Sheshanak. And then it is Balaram who is manifesting himself with his unlimited hoods and with unlimited mouths. He is glorifying Krishna and he's never finding the end of Krishna's qualities, and he just continues to glorify Krishna. And it is said that in the Chaitanya Bhagavad that the mouth of Ananta Sage is the jewel case for the glorification of Krishna. In other words, that one must approach Ananta Sage if one wants to glorify Krishna. Otherwise, it is not possible. So, Balaram is attracted to those who take up his work of serving Krishna. And when the Lord is attracted to the devotee, only then is mercy manifesting in that devotee. That is the nature of mercy, that the Lord becomes attracted to his devotee. Of course, it is sometimes said the mercy of the Lord is causeless. Causeless, that means that he can also give the mercy to anyone and everyone, even one who is not his devotee. But the devotee has the power to attract that causeless mercy. The mercy of the Lord is always available, and it's said like rain. Rain that may fall on water, rain that may fall on rock, and rain that may fall on fertile soil, it will produce different results. On rock, not much result, it just runs off. On fertile soil, it will produce plants. And in water, in those who are already full of mercy, it will just increase their transcendental pleasure eternally. And in this way, even those who are full of love of God will advance eternally. There is no limit to one's love for Krishna. Love for Krishna is eternally increasing, eternally. I like a particular passage of the Chaitanya Charitamrita where it is described that the love of Srimati Radharani is compared to a mirror that reflects the unlimited qualities of Krishna. And it is said that the love of Srimati Radharani is embracing the qualities of Krishna and exploring the qualities of Krishna. And as she is discovering another quality of Krishna, whose qualities are just unlimited, then she loves that quality also. And in this way her love expands. And then she discovers another quality of Krishna. And she loves, immediately she loves that quality again. And in this way her love is just growing and growing and growing. And this is a wonderful explanation of how spiritual life is eternally increasing and how it's never stagnant or that one, and therefore not boring, therefore not for eternity we are fanning Krishna and we are stand there fan forever, and at one point think, can we sometimes do something else? But no, Krishna's servants, like Daruka, they can fan Krishna eternally. But because there is endless qualities in Krishna to discover, the love of his devotees is eternally increasing. So we've already started that process. Therefore Prabhupada would see the devotees as lovers of Krishna. He would see that even conditioned devotees are lovers of Krishna. He would see. It's beginning. Prabhupada's looking, oh yes. We love to ring bells for Krishna. We do these things out of love. Yes. Therefore, we love it also. Because it is a bell that is glorifying Krishna. It is a bell that is. It is interesting. I was reading some article by some professor who went to a Shinto temple in Japan, and he was saying, you know, like many other places of worship in India, or sorry, in Asia, when they enter, they ring a bell, you know, as if God is sleeping, he said. Yeah. As if God is sleeping. Yeah. But no. The professor missed the point, right? It's not that God is sleeping, it's that we are sleeping. So we ring the bell to wake up ourselves. Right? That's why the bell, when the curtains are closing, then it's like, now is your last chance to catch a glimpse of the Lord. He's been on the altar, we didn't even bother to look. Ding, ding, ding. Look now, before it's too late. Ding, ding, ding. Before the curtains open. Ding, ding, ding. The curtains are opening. Ding, ding, ding. Wake up. Where are you? On cloud nine, of course. Come down. Come down to earth and see. So, everything is part of that art of discovering Krishna's qualities and in this way loving Krishna, more and more loving Krishna. So this is our business. Therefore, we are interesting. That Krishna appears in this world as Kapila Dev, as Yajnamurti, to establish Yuga Dharmas, to not abandon the conditioned souls, but to give them a chance to return to worship. But we carry on with our our worship of Krishna, so that we can gradually rise above material conditioning and become non-envious. Envy is a big issue in our life. You know, so many things disturb us. People disturb us. So to try and be favorable, to just be non-envious. How nice! I always think when I hear these bells, something in my mind is like trying to speak, and it's like, ding, 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 ding. And it's hard to concentrate, of course, you know.
Concentration is flowing all over the place.
Yeah. But then I think of of parents, right, who have a kid, and the kid is just like banging banging with some wooden hammer on some toy that makes a horrible noise, you know. And it's the kind of toy, right, where when you come to that house, you know, it's a hellish toy, and you just think about, how can I steal this toy, destroy this toy, get rid of this toy somehow or other. Why did these parents buy this demoniac toy for this kid? But, you know, when you say something to the parents, you say, what a toy, you know, so if you can't say what a horrible toy, so you say, what a toy, you say, and then they say, yes, little Johnny loves it so much. And then you see that a non-envious perspective, right? Me, totally envious, want to destroy Johnny's toy as soon as possible, but the parents are, ah, he loves it so much. So this is, from this, I meditate on this when I detect a trace of envy emerging and try to cut it right there and say, no, appreciate, no. In this way, we are trying to cut the material influences that emerge, such as envy, lust, and greed, at the root, and simply at the root. And if we do so, then we are purely situated. And we are purely situated. Maybe with time, more and more, we become just so kind to everyone that we just very nicely are becoming well-wishers. Still, we see that Prabhupada would just send ladies with babies out of lectures. That's also there. Prabhupada didn't like noises. He didn't. He was quite sensitive to slamming doors, for example. If a door would slam, in, especially in India, these things, they are, you know, it's like in big buildings, windy in Mayapur, endless slamming doors. Prabhupada would say the sound of these slamming doors would break his heart. He didn't like it, so he made it quite clear that he wanted to doors to be properly closed and no unnecessary noises. Prabhupada is imitating noises of like garbage trucks. Something like that. I'd imagine. Prabhupada is imitating sounds and very good at it. Imitating the sound of these big American cars. Like, you know, Whirlpool in the petrol tank and so on, V8s. Well, so Prabhupada didn't like noise, but he could tolerate also. Prabhupada, so the personalist may create space for undisturbed Krishna Katha, but at other times, Prabhupada was extremely tolerant. So one might sometimes suspect that his intolerance was actually there so that the audience could hear. But whatever may be, that due preference is given to the glorification of Krishna. That is the ultimate point, whether one is distracted or not. Preference should be given to the glorification of Krishna. That is there. Because we want to increase that glorification of Krishna. Because we want to explore the unlimited qualities and nature of Krishna. So that our love for Krishna can increase. That's the idea. Shouldn't drag it on too long. So, it's your turn.
You were talking about the cow herding the cows. Mr. Zuma, Jacob Zuma, was a herd boy.
There you go.
So there's something in common you can look for. But now the thing is this, you're particularly interested in this African Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
And to understand African people,
yeah,
you're going to have to go into the tradition a little bit.
Yeah.
Because to penetrate in here, I don't see much penetration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the way forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I respect your idea, but mm-hmm. I don't see very much implementation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good point. Yeah, it's true. I think so too. I think that a lot more should be done. And I think also that Krishna consciousness, when it reached the shores of South Africa, Prabhupada came. Of course, some devotees had come before. And apartheid South Africa was not so tolerant, you know, of other type of ideas. So devotees went to the Indian community and really established themselves there. And that phase of Krishna consciousness was sort of brought to a mature stage. Yeah, the Indian support base, and you know, we have a lot in South Africa. So that was very good. And then came the stage two, reaching out to other communities, especially the African community. And there we are still in work was done initially in a charitable manner, right? Food for life, you know. And here comes food for life, and we got food for life. And a bin of biryani, right? Like taken to a squatter camp or something. And that is very good, of course, because people are poor, there is a need, and people are appreciative. And we've seen the benefits of food for life. There is this family in Durban who became held up, you know, by some gundas in the house or whatever, you know, who when they found there was a whole gang in the house and very wealthy people, and but when they found a beat bag, right, then in the house said, oh, these are these Hare Krishna people. Oh, these are the ones that feed our people. Oh, don't kill them. Yeah. And they put locked the family in the bathroom and cleaned out the house, you know, which, you know, is quite good considering the situation. So the food for life went a long way, but it's not good enough, because it's top down, it's a vertical approach, from like and that in a country where so long a condescending history has existed, you know, like that will not help, right? We need equality. So this is the next challenge, to actually reach out to the African community on the basis of equality, and to say, yes, you know, we are all equal spirit souls, and we all have an equal opportunity to serve Krishna. It takes a little bit of adjustment, because it means we have to sit with someone as our neighbor, at prasadam and so on, and share our lives. That takes a lot of emotional adjustment. And in the Indian culture, is not against segregating community. communities. The Indian culture or Vedic culture is not into merging all different communities, but it wants a relationship of kindness and mercy between the communities, and not an exploitive one. Like Prabhupada didn't have so much problem with apartheid, that different communities were separated from each other. And of course there is the proverb, birds of a feather flock together. So there's something to say for that. The exploitive element was the problem, where one group lives in, just driving up to the airport, where one group lives in the tin sheds, right? Or as our Sita Ram, who has a way with words, right, I must admit, wrote in his biography, his autobiography, in the townships we have dry crust of breads, and over the hill they have cake. Which sort of summed it up nicely. To become more relevant to the African community is important. So our latest move had been to establish an African BBT, or to start translating books in the African language, because we found that wherever we did reach out to the African community, that they were extremely interested, extremely. For example, if you would go to a technicon here in South Africa with predominantly African students, you would get 40 questions. And you go to some, university with some Indian audience, can you explain something about karma? You get one question like that, some sort of dead question, right, that's like been asked. It's like there's hardly any juice left in it, it's been asked so many times. Whereas the Africans were asking like fundamental, real questions about life, you're speaking about regulative principles, but how does that relate to life? How can we live like that? Right? And then I'm saying, how does it make sense? No illicit sex, how does that make sense? Good question, because, So in this way, we found that the African community actually not only is interested in Bayani, right? No, we found that actually they were quite hungry for knowledge, and very interesting. So in this effort to start printing books in African languages, a new era started a few years ago, and then it took some time, but now we do have a book in the language, I can't do it, in the Xhosa language, which we're looking at ways now to motivate the devotees to distribute these books, and this should be like an agenda topic. So it is coming down. I think you're right that we're not penetrating, but I do see that it is gradually coming down, and the time it took to get established in the Indian community is a great asset in South Africa, because it gives us a tremendous support base. It gives us a financial support base, it gives us a cultural support base. Therefore, the combination of these two is what can make Krishna consciousness very strong in South Africa. But we have to take the austerity of penetrating into the African community, and we are trying. So I came here in 1995 in an injured condition, because some idiot in India decided to shoot me in the back, which is not so good for the back and nor for the front, because it goes right through you. So I came for recovery to South Africa, and I was here for half a year in Durban, and the devotees of Indian community, they really took care of me super good. I mean, so, and I needed that, so that was nice, and I appreciated that a lot. And so that kind of bound me to, in affectionate relationships, to South Africa. So I came back to South Africa. But after a time, after a while, you know, there were many Namahattas in Durban, and I felt that it wasn't enough, you know, to just go around the Namahattas and be a, and have a sort of a mutual appreciation relationship. Oh, it's so nice you have come. Oh, it's so nice that you are here. Oh, it's so nice that, you know, oh, you've made such a nice cake and such nice dokos, and it is so nice, Danya Chutney, so nice, and oh, you're leading such a nice kirtan, and it is all so nice. So it was all very nice, but then I was thinking, yes, but outside it's not so nice. So I started to think about how to do something in South Africa. Now, I do have, since I am Dutch, I did have an auntie, you know, who married an Afrikaner, right, in South Africa, who was a painter. His name was Frans Uhler, and he had paintings of African scenes and people and so on. So my auntie brought a painting to my grandmother, and it was hanging in the living room, and it showed this African man sitting in front of a straw hut, kind of in a very, well, rural setting of African life. So when I was in South Africa thinking about black preaching, I thought, or outreaching to the black community, I thought for a while, should I go live in one of these huts, like on the painting of my grandmother? But I wasn't quite convinced that this was my calling in life, actually. And then I remembered something Prabhupada said. And Prabhupada, you know, spoke about a Bengali proverb which describes that the art is to catch the fish without getting wet. Yeah. So I liked that approach. So therefore I thought, like, well, should I move into a township? And I was like, well, don't really want to live in a township, to be honest. I mean, it doesn't attract me. I'd rather live in a more sattvic environment, in goodness. But then how will we reach the people? So I thought, well, I'll help local people, yeah, to work in their environment. So in the last few years, we have done that. We have now, like, several settlements in townships, around Durban, around Pretoria, Johannesburg, and we have a temple in Mafeking. We appointed an African devotee in charge as president of Pretoria. So it's not a lot of penetration, but it is a foundation of more to come. It is beginning to lay a foundation. My plan is to create many such township centers. But it means I have to find African devotees who speak the language, who are local, who are willing to go there. Then we'll finance them with a seed capital. And we'll try and get them some support and so on. And in this way, we hope to build up a network where gradually the penetration takes place. And then there's another area. And there is the internet. There is Facebook. Yeah. There are so many areas where we can reach out. So there's an immense amount of work to do. But the penetration is happening bit by bit.
But when you went Durban, didn't you notice the humanity of the Zulu people? It quite struck me when I went
there. Yeah.
They don't look at you as a stranger. They say, here's the phone, there's still some money on the phone. You can get it on. It struck me that the perfect strangers are very kind.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunity. But, you know, we are all individuals, right? And we are, as individuals, we're balancing many things. Yeah? We have to balance that we ourselves follow four regulated principles. You don't do that without any shelter. Right? It's good to live in a transcendental atmosphere, transcendental association, if you're trying to follow four regulated principles for a lifetime. You can follow for a while, but if you want to maintain it for a lifetime, you better protect your four regulated principles. So that's one thing to balance. Then another thing is, yes, we have a conditioning, right? It's not that we have to be suicidal heroes and deny who we are, where we came from. Rather, we engage that nature, that conditioned nature, in the service of Krishna, and then build on it, right? We don't just run out of our situation all at once and go live in the forest, you know, without clothes, and try to develop mystic cities to raise the temperature of the body. No, we stay with clothes. We stay with house. We stay with community. We stay with many things for our support. Right? So that we stay with a certain level of comfort zone. Comfort zone is required. There's three zones: comfort zone, stretching zone, pain zone. If you're too long in the pain zone, you have to go into a hospital. Yeah. So some comfort zone is required. So we must proceed in a balanced way. So we try to penetrate, but not in a way where we lose our own strength. So therefore the devotees are penetrating, but they're a little careful also, that they keep their own spiritual life protected. And a balance has to be kept. Otherwise it's not going to be possible. Because as soon as you go out to a materialist to preach, it's two-way traffic. It's not that we are preaching to them, they're preaching to us also. It's a tug of war, and both are pulling full force. And sometimes there's a lot of them pulling, you know, when it's one against one. But what if it is you and 100? What if you are the only Krishna conscious one and there's 100 people who are like just taking your energy and they're not following the principles? They're sucking your energy and it pulls you down. So one must be sure that there is also that. Sometimes you go out to the crowds and you let them pull and you're alone, but then you must come back to be with some others who pull you towards Krishna. So this kind of balance we have to very carefully maintain. So it's not just a black and white situation, you know. Well, what's wrong? Why don't you just jump in? Jump in and drown. No thanks. Jump in and be eaten by the sharks. Make sure I have a cage, right? Yeah. You don't go diving here, you know, in the midst of the sharks without a cage. Yeah. Of course, there may be some who know how to do that, but maybe you will go without a cage.
Oh, definitely.
But not me. I'll go with a cage. I won't even go at all.
This cage thing is totally wrong.
Okay.
It's a cause of the whole melody.
Yeah.
It really
Yeah. Well, you know there is a saying, you know, it is when the four musketeers or the three musketeers, when the three musketeers came together, right? And they're all great knights and warriors, and then they said, like, you know, each man for himself and God for us all. And that's my last word to you. Each man for himself and God for us all. Oh, Mr. Musketeer. Yes.
I just want to make one's a question, one's a point on the last topic of African preaching. I definitely noticed, which is interesting, is that African body cultural people as a generalization definitely recognize the gospel element of our process. If you go into the street and you chant, the people, the African mamas, for example, will be chanting with you spontaneously much easier than anyone else. Like if we take a train, sometimes we go a high number of trains, and when we go on third class as opposed to metro plus, the first class, there's a complete difference, you know, in terms of the response from people.
Sure.
And although they can't necessarily make sense of it, and it is weird and fun, because of this natural affection for religion within an African person, it's quite amazing to see. Because ultimately it's the goal to be chanting, so you can very much appreciate the fact that they can do that so naturally. And it's definitely something to work with.
Yeah, there's so much opportunity, definitely.
It's a nice, I just thought I'd share that.
Yeah, appreciate it.
You know, just in reference to the class, we're making this point about the guru originally coming from Balaram, Balaram being the servitor guardian, providing everything. I wanted to know the distinction between Radharani and Balaram, because, you know, we make the prayer Hare Krishna, that please, the Lord, the energy of the Lord, engage me in your service. But we know that it's the Guru that is engaging us. Where does Radharani fit in between Guru and service?
Radharani is also Guru. But Radharani, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he makes the distinction, and he says that for the conditioned souls, Nityananda Balaram. For those liberated souls who are in Madhurya Ras, Radharani becomes the Guru. But otherwise, Balaram. So we should not prematurely turn to her as the predominant Guru. That's why Srila Prabhupada was not going along with the Vrindavan culture, Radhe Radhe. Yeah. Radhe Radhe. No. That is a particular by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's words, that is reserved for those who develop that particular ras, and that comes very late. One must be very spiritually advanced for that. So therefore, in our foreground it's Nityananda Balaram. Right? It's through the mercy of Nityananda. And I think we are underestimating the need for that, you know, like at this phase of the cultural climate in our society, a lot of interest in Vrindavan has come in, and we hear a lot about, you know, Vrindavan pastimes, Vrindavan this and Vrindavan that. And of course, these are very sweet and so on. But we're not going to make it. We're not going to make it to enter into these Vrindavan pastimes, to become absorbed without taking shelter of Nityananda Balaram. So, in that way, then once we are there in these Vrindavan pastimes, then we can more and more appreciate Srimati Radharani. So it's not that we don't appreciate Srimati Radharani, it's not that we don't look at her as a model of perfection. She is guru for all of us, but not like the guru that we are in our day-to-day actively taking as a role model. Our role model is Balaram, and the line coming from Balaram. That is he is Adi Guru or Nityananda. And their mood is just to be the menial servant of Krishna all the time. Whereas with Radharani it becomes more complex, because there is this Kamanuga element. Kamanuga, there is in the rasas, there are four rasas, there are Sambandhanuga. They deal with, well, the followers of just the relationship of servitor through that relationship of parental friendship and servitorship or neutral. But in this Madhurya Ras, it looks like the gopis are enjoyers also. It looks like that very much. It appears like that. And they when Krishna ignores them, they get in a sulken mood and like, yeah. And all these things, and then when they are with Krishna, it's like so it's very, very difficult to understand how all these things are going on in the mood of servitude, and one must approach it very patiently, carefully, thoughtfully, and ever. I'm following Prabhupada and being a little reserved in describing so many of the pastimes of Krishna and the gopis. Because I think, and that's why I'm emphasizing Chaitanya Mahaprabhu so much. Yeah. It's not that I don't have appreciation for Radha and Krishna and Vrindavan and these pastimes. That's not the case. I do. And it's not that I never read about Radharani and about different stories, but I don't tell them so much because I feel that we are not putting enough emphasis on the need for the mercy, because we are all quite fallen, actually. Behind the devotional facade, we are quite fallen. And we really need the mercy of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda. Very much so. And that mood of being a selfless servant, just menial servant. Lord Chaitanya sends Nityananda, go door to door. Nityananda is going door to door. Okay. What is that? We have to go door to door. Can think about it. Should we go door to door? The Jehovah Witnesses, they do. That we got to grant them. Wherever they are in the world, they do.
Preachers in the world, actually.
They do. Well, debatably so.
We had a preaching spirit like that. I mean, I don't know when we fall much faster.
Yeah. Well, you used to have. Remember?
That's true. That's going on. That's kind of
there was a time when we were on fire.
Yeah.
We were not. And going door to door, climbing through every window. That used to be our movement.
Maharaj, the incarnations come for different reasons. Why did Yagya need to come?
To establish Yagya. It is like for the Treta Yuga, when Yagya is the predominant process, then he counts as the Yuga avatar to establish that. It is the Yuga, the Yuga Dharma for that. The Treta Yuga. is yagya, where great sacrifices, where everyone joins. It's the one thing that everyone gets behind, a great sacrifice, and the whole community or whole society is engaged in that way by pious kings, and in that way the Supreme Lord becomes the center of society and everyone begins to cooperate to worship. So that's how, if people were still inclined towards yagya, then they could be united like that. Yeah. But then gradually it splinters up more. The society becomes less and less united. So then in the Dwapara Yuga, many deities everywhere. Yeah. So like, okay, everywhere groups of people splinter, divided, worship with deities. Kali Yuga, you know what I mean? No more sense of regulation, no more seriousness, deity worship. Then, how do you keep them? You see the mentality of the people changes. Yeah.
I was just thinking, this is an exception where we got your Satya, Treta, Dwapara, and Kali. So when it's the right way around, then is it the fire sacrifices and the Treta, the third one?
I don't know. I don't know. I know about this swapping of the yugas somehow or other, but I haven't read anything. But it's can't say. If then it's also, if then it's the third one. I can think. I can speculate, but I'm not going to. I'm just going to say I don't know. So I have to ask a pundit who knows, who's read something about that. I haven't read anything. Then we find this references in Bhagavad Bhagavatamrita about this changing of the yugas. Jiva Goswami repeats it also. But
then this is the exception. It is true that the one overlaps, that the Dwapara is the one coming after, is actually the exception.
No, that's all right, but she's asking about the processes, if then the sequence of the processes also change or whatever. There's no explanation of that. I don't know. Oh, you are the last member. Okay.
If I may, just take it back again to understand. Just from what I've seen personally, very small examples about penetrating what Prabhupada just very passionate about, Utfala, and he actually brought all children here recently. But before he did that, when he was planning to do it, when we were there, one of the kids, I mean, you see them, they just pick up any instrument to make them spare.
Yeah.
And the kid asked him, when I go up, can I be a Krishna leader? And I thought that was like something penetrative that feels not.
Right.
And then when they came to the temple, the way this floor was shaking and the energy in this room, it's like pure, just spontaneous, you know?
Right.
And I was doing book distribution once in Kern once, and I met this African lady.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, Radhika. Yeah, you're right. You know, it's penetrating. It is, and it's something like, you know, it's, you know, like I used to be in charge of construction of a big building, and then water is the biggest enemy of a building, so the water finds a crack. And it goes into the building, and then it is in, and it finds its way. It penetrates all the way through the building, and then one day it comes out like a big leak. But then actually there was already a lot of water in the building before it comes out. So in this way, it's penetrating everywhere. You know, all those people on the train, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's so many. They chant Hare Krishna. on the station. Rondebos station is Krishna's arrangement that he put the temple at Rondebos station, because just the kirtans preach automatically to the trains. Just any question, Rajbala, or a comment? You want to say a word of welcome? Arrival. We're happy to see you. Are you warm enough? Good. Okay, well, we'll finish then. Thank you.